This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Sabri Benishour, in for David Brancaccio. The world's population hit 8 billion today, just as representatives from 190 or so countries continue week two of the UN Climate Change Conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres had a pretty stark warning at the open: cooperate or perish. One focus of the summit, which is known as COP27, has been how to help lower-income countries deal with climate disasters. Vijay Vaithyaswaran attended the meeting last week. He's The Economist's Global Energy and Climate Innovation Editor, and he's here to fill us in. Good morning.
Hello there.
So I guess first, really, we should talk about the state of climate change as it is now. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, "We're on a climate highway to hell. CO2 levels are now 50% higher than they were before the Industrial Revolution." How bad is all that?
So the picture is not great, but it's maybe not as bad as some of the speakers in the opening of the climate change summit indicated, including the Secretary General, Al Gore, and a litany of horrors that were unveiled by other world leaders. The climate change picture is getting worse. We know we have some of the hottest years on record recently, confirmed yet again, and we're blowing past the goal that was set by the United Nations Paris Accord to try to contain the warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. That's a bit of a magic number to try to minimize the harm that's done to the Earth from various forms of climate impacts. We're going to blow right past that. There's really no realistic chance of containing warming within 1.5 degrees. We recently argued in a cover story last week the reasons why. But the UN hasn't caught up with that, or at least politically, they're still sticking with keep 1.5 alive. That's the mantra of COP. So that's not good news. On the flip side, actually, we'll see probably not as bad on the upside in terms of climate change increasing the temperature of the Earth or other forms of harms than we previously thought. The pace of deployment of clean energy, particularly around the world, has been quite fast in the last 10 years, thanks to the collapsing price of solar, for example, and other forms of renewable technologies that has become a lot cheaper. Frankly, it's the cheapest way to build new power plants anywhere in the world, cheaper than new coal or new gas, is to put up solar plants. And for those sorts of reasons of more rapid deployment of clean energy, we're actually seeing something like the International Energy Agency say they think fossil fuels will peak by 2030, coal, oil, and gas.
Well, given all that, what would you say the mood of the summit was?
Whenever you go to a climate summit like these COP summits at the UN, and I've been to a number over the years, it's always a mix of gloom and doom because the picture is basically not great, right? At the same time, you find that is motivating actions. And sometimes it's not on the official UN stage. So there was a lot of optimism, actually, for coalitions of the willing, that is, corporate alliances combined with a couple of countries that get together to announce partnerships on carbon credits, or philanthropies announcing big amounts of money for adaptation funding. And so you're finding a huge amount of bottom-up action. And that's what we saw last week in the first week of COP. So I think that part is enthusiastic and optimistic. We still need the world to act in concert because this is the most global problem. So we still need the UN process to work. And that's where there's more pessimism.
One of the more difficult issues has been this argument between developing countries and rich countries, in which rich countries are, you know, responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions. But a lot of developing countries, some of whom have very little in the way of emissions, are paying more of the price in the form of climate disasters or rising sea level. I'm curious if, from a moral perspective, are all countries on that same page?
If you say, what is the official negotiating position? The answer is no. There's no way that a number of the developing countries, certainly not the United States, is going to accept an outcome that says you are legally responsible and you have to pay reparations for having gotten rich burning fossil fuels. Right? That's the nub of it when we call it loss and damage. What it means is the harm that particularly the developing world will suffer, which didn't yet have a chance to grow rich, to industrialize the way that the rich world did, wants the rich world to pay a lot of money and to accept responsibility. The U.S. will never accept that, as well as some other rich countries that are quietly riding on America's coattails without speaking up, because, of course, it would open a can of worms. It becomes really unlimited liability, lawsuits, you could imagine where it would go. And politically, we will, in the U.S. body politic, are not going to pay reparations, certainly not with the Congress that's likely to be in place in a few days. So the bottom line is that framing is not likely to succeed, even if there's some tokenism. There might be a bit of talking shop, maybe a few billion here, a few billion there thrown in there. But the developing countries that are pushing for that scored an own goal by demanding that China and India also be included in those reparations, in the loss and damage contributions. Now, China actually, the moral case is pretty strong. China is a pretty rich country. I lived there for almost a decade for my magazine covering it. And there's a lot of wealth in China, and it burned a lot of coal. It's still burning a huge amount of coal. But India, there's no way a country that's still largely poor, that is yet to really industrialize the way it wants to, is ever going to pay these sorts of reparations. So the politics of this are falling apart, frankly, at Sharm el-Sheikh.
Well, I mean, that said, lower-income countries do want and need some assistance, either reducing their own emissions or coping with the consequences of climate change. Are they going to get it? Whether any responsibility is acknowledged either way, I mean, are they going to get help?
I think the answer there is a little bit brighter than that moral question we just dealt with. They are going to get more help. Some of this will come through the old-fashioned way, that is official donor aid bilaterally from countries like Britain, and the United States as well has increased its funding for adaptation and for other sorts of ways of helping developing countries cope with these problems. There's also philanthropic money. The Rockefeller and Gates Foundations announced big initions.
This is the Marketplace Morning Report. Dollars, I'm Sabri Benishore,
as well as
in for David Brancaccio.
Programmatic help for developing countries, technical help in coping with agriculture, for example, where smallholder farmers are going to deal with the double whammy of too little water, meaning crops that are suffering from drought, but suddenly too much water, as we saw in Pakistan with the massive floods recently. So they're going to need technical help with those things. We are seeing forms of assistance. Now, they're nowhere near the scale of the tragedy that's going to come, but we've got the marker down for scaling up these sorts of fiddly on-the-ground ways to help that I think actually make a big difference.
The U.S. has proposed a carbon credit system where developing countries, poor countries, they lower their emissions, and then they sell credit for doing that to companies, so the companies can use that as offsets for their own pollution. How feasible is that? How popular is that?
So this is an interesting idea. So in theory, anything that will get more money from the rich world to developing countries to build out the renewables energy sectors, to power down and reduce coal use, is a good thing. When we look at the scenarios for how we clean up the energy system in the next 20, 30 years, most of the money that's going to be needed has to flow to emerging markets. And by official estimates, we find there's a short gap. A sixth of the money that's needed is getting there, maybe even 1/10 only. That is, we need to have a vast increase. And the obstacles to those include things like foreign exchange risk, country risk, project risk. You know, there's lots of reasons why the vast flows of capital in the rich world are not going to these projects in the developing world. So if this new mechanism can provide some sort of state-level guarantee, some transparency, some authentication of those credits that, in fact, a country is reducing its coal use and building legitimate new projects in clean energy that are verified, that's great. The danger, though, is that if it's not done with rigor, it'll just end up as another greenwashing exercise, and that's the worry.
Well, what ultimately do you think is going to come out of this summit? What concrete results might come of this summit?
So these UN summits are talking shops, right? They happen every year. And this one is a little COP, they call it. Every 5 years, they have a big COP. Last year in Glasgow was a very big COP. And so the expectations have to be in the right place. There's no major breakthrough that's anticipated. It's not even on the cards. Areas where there's likely to be some discussion, as we discussed, is loss and damage, the reparations issue. I don't think there'll be a resolution on that, for the politics are too hard. On climate financing, though, I think there's a lot of action that's happening informally through coalitions of the willing. We see, even as the world leaders shift to Indonesia for a G20 summit, in a sense, geopolitics is entering the fray. We've seen President Biden meet with Xi Jinping for the first time, very important for geopolitics, but it's also very important for climate, because these two giant emitters have to work together. Without America and China rowing in the same direction, there's no hope of accomplishing anything on climate. And that actually has been positive. We've seen negotiators from the two countries at COP sit down and discuss ways of getting back in touch after a very difficult few months and sort of animosity and lack of trust. They're working back together. So I think at that kind of fiddly bilateral bottom-up level, I think we're going to see progress come out of this COP, but it's not going to be a big announcement like the Paris Accord or another agenda-setting kind of outcome.
Vijay Vaithiswaran is the Economist Global Energy and Climate Innovation Editor. He attended COP27 last week. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.